My guest today, Krista Couture, is an award-winning performing and recording artist, filmmaker, writer, and broadcaster. She is also proudly Indigenous, mixed Cree and Scandinavian, queer, disabled, and a mom. Her seventh album, Safe Harbor, was released on Koch's Records in 2020. And as a writer and a storyteller, Krista has been published in Room, Shameless, Auger Magazine. She's gone viral on the CBC with an article and photos on disability and pregnancy. Krista is also a frequent contributor to CBC Radio and is currently the weekday afternoon host on 106.5 Element FM in Toronto. And her life has been both extraordinary and fiercely engaged. She is utterly awake and connected and alive and joyful, which is a pretty powerful state for her to be in, given the stunning amount of loss that has touched down in her life, from the loss of her leg in her early teens to the loss of children, a sense of identity, community, and the need to find a way to reimagine life, not just exist, but also live in the face of deeply challenging circumstances. In her debut memoir, How to Lose Everything, she shares many of these stories, and we dive into this extraordinary path, the revelations, her lens on life, possibility, hope, and grace. And what you'll really be moved by is this sense of underlying joy, this fabric of lightness in the context of a life experience that people could look at and think, wow, that has been really tough. And yet somehow she's not Pollyannistic, she's not delusionally hopeful or optimistic, but she has found a way to reconnect with a sense of lightness, hope, and possibility that I think we could all learn from. So excited to share this conversation with you. I'm Jonathan Fields, and this is Good Life Project.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good Life Project is sponsored by the ADHD Aha podcast, hosted by Laura Key. So I've been kind of amazed at how many conversations I've had lately with people later in life who are wondering if they have ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. So in each episode of ADHD Aha, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, even funny ways that ADHD symptoms surface for adults. Like the recent episode with ADHD coach Emily Weinberg, which really resonated with me. Her story about how she was thinking she was, quote, just lazy before her diagnosis because she wasn't hyperactive really struck a chord. Her feeling frozen and stuck, ruminating on mounting to-do lists is just so relatable for so many people. It's really validating to hear others articulate those experiences. Each episode of ADHD Aha features candid tales of realizing that you or a loved one has ADHD. You'll hear the unexpected, emotional ways that it manifests in adults through heartfelt interviews. ADHD Aha captures the authentic human experience of ADHD. So if you want a fresh, personal perspective that embraces the messiness, listen to ADHD Aha. Search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. It's an aha moment you won't miss. There's something really important that I think we need to talk about first, and that is the fact that apparently you fold everything, including dishcloths. We got to start with the important stuff here.
Yes, I do. I do fold everything. Oh my gosh. My secret is out. I mean, well, I'm a very like tidy, very organized person. And you know, on one hand, I love like opening the drawer to everything being neatly tidied and put away, because then it's like pleasing. It's like a small little tiny moment of, you know, it's like having fresh flowers. It's just like, oh, that's nice. And I think for a while, I mean, there was probably a part in my life where any little mishap would crush me. And I think it sort of turned me into a bit of a neat freak, because it meant that that was an area of my life I could feel some control over. So there was a time where it just kind of served me well to think, okay, well, at least I can fold these dishcloths and put them away so that when I open the drawer, it's not total chaos. I can't do much else. So I think I've always been a tidy person, but I think it probably got heightened in the last 10 years. But yes, it's true. It's true. I think I know where you maybe got that information.
Some secret intel. All I'm going to share is that the person who relayed this very critical intel to me said that it also happened to be pretty life-changing for them. So
that's good to hear. It's had a positive
resisted effect in the beginning, right? But then ultimately life-changing in every way imaginable. So you grew up, it sounds like to a certain extent, kind of splitting your time, part with your mom in Canada and then summers-ish with your dad in Montclair, New Jersey, just outside of New York, for those who don't know where that is. Your dad was Cree, and it sounds like he was a healer. Was the culture, sort of like the First Nations culture, a part of your life from the earliest days? I'm curious.
Yeah. And in this way that I wouldn't have known was remarkable or even to name, because it was just there. And my dad did also live in Northern Alberta. There was, yeah, definitely split my time in a few homes as per like custody agreements and my parents both moving a lot. And so where he lived in Northern Alberta was on a Cree reserve, and he was a healer. And so, you know, at my dad's house, there was a sweat lodge and usually one or two teepees in the yard. And he ran various ceremonies. And in the summers, we would go to another camp where he ran fasts for people. And my sister and I would just be running around in the field and he would be doing that work. And so, you know, as a kid, I took it for granted that this was present in my life and that I had access to ceremony, which of course, for a lot of Indigenous people, there's been, you know, a break for a lot of heartbreaking reasons. And so I feel really grateful that it was just there. I mean, the sorrow I feel about it now is that, you know, as a teenager, I was like, oh, okay, whatever, Dad. And then by the time in my 20s, I was ready to sort of come back and say, okay, wait, can we now talk about this? Can you share these teachings with me in a more, you know, explicit way? Was when he was sick and when he died. And so I wasn't able to kind of learn more from him in a more direct way, but of course it shaped me and it was there in my childhood.
Yeah. I mean, even just to know that this is a part of you from the earliest days and to learn through osmosis, through just being around it, I think that's so powerful. And it's something that I've become kind of fascinated with, the concept of lineage and heritage over the last couple of years. Maybe I'm at that point in my life where I'm getting curious about it. And I feel like so often, so many of us really know nothing about, you know, not just our parents as human beings, but also the lineage that, you know, their parents and their parents and their parents and what may have been lost along the way.
Yeah. And it's interesting what gets shared, because my dad was also French. Like my last name, Couture, was my dad's last name. But I know like nothing about French Canadian culture. Like, you know, I would feel a bit shaky saying, I mean, I could say a French Canadian ancestry, but I don't feel like I'm part of that sort of cultural group in the present. Whereas from my mother's side, she's Scandinavian and her parents lived in New Norway, Alberta, kind of says it all right there. And so there was some presence of that, you know, I'd hear the stories and some of the words and the way they talked about being Norwegian and Swedish was there. But yeah, I am also part French, but I don't really talk about it because I'm like, I wouldn't know what to say. So it's interesting with the lineage, because it's also like what happened to be present. And so I can't, the ways that I think of myself, I mean, I think of my father very much as a Cree person, although he was also mixed, you know, technically.
Yeah. And on the Cree side too, I mean, so your English name is Krista, but you have a different Cree name, which also is, I mean, you can peel that onion in a lot of different ways. There's a lot of foreshadowing in the name that you were given at the youngest of ages.
Yeah. So there's a really beautiful thing that happens with our traditional names, which can be given at any time. And people can even be given one as a child, a different one as an adult. It can change. But I had a naming ceremony when I was, I think, around two. with an elder that my father was learning with. He was actually Arapaho, and even though we were Cree, but we'd gone down to Wyoming. And so in my naming ceremony, I was given the name Saini Bay, which means singing woman. And we came out of that ceremony, and the elder Raymond told my family, she's going to sing a lot and she's going to talk a lot. And exactly, it became this, you know, in retrospect, it's very accurate, but also this sort of prophecy. And our traditional names are a way to sort of describe where you might go, but they're also a way to be reminded of your gifts or your contribution or your place in your community. I mean, many Indigenous cultures, certainly in our Cree community, like, it's community first. And that's not to say that the self is unimportant, but that's sort of where self-care can come from, is if our community is cared for, that we will all be cared for. And so when we think about our traditional names, it's telling us, how do we care for our community? How do we contribute? And so for me, a singing woman, I contribute and I care and I give and I share by singing, by writing, by telling stories. And so it's a really beautiful perspective to have, you know, to think about your life as sort of this guiding story.
Mm. I mean, it's interesting to me also that, as you just shared, that might change later in life. You might be given a different name, which is kind of fascinating to me, because if the name translates in some way, shape, or form to what you might understand as an identity, and then in your 20s or 30s, you're given a different name, then you're kind of like, wait,
right?
This isn't just a different name. Do you mean, like, I'm now an entirely different identity? Have I just grown into it? Or was the first one wrong? And, like, you start reexamining, like, the last, you know, couple of decades of life.
Yeah. And I actually only recently learned that I could get a new name because I was kind of having an identity crisis.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah. That's bang on, because in the book, but I had thyroid cancer a couple years ago, and through the surgery, my singing voice was impacted for a while. It has mostly recovered. But at the time, I was primarily a touring singer-songwriter, and I thought, man, if I'm not singing, like, I can't call myself singing woman. Like, I just, what do I say? Who am I? And now who am I in my community if I'm not the person singing? And then I learned from someone else who was like, oh, just go get a new name. Just talk to your elders and say, hey, this is what's happening. And I think, I mean, there's a beautiful thing often with our teachings, or what has been shared with me, is that, you know, you take from it what you need. And so if at some point if you need a new name, if you need another way to ground yourself, you know, you can ask and see, you know, see what the answer is. But I found through finding out, oh, I could get a new name. Like, do I need to do that? And then in talking to some other Indigenous people and through some other circumstances, the name gave me a tool to reconsider my role. And I, you know, I said that Raymond said she'll talk a lot or she'll sing a lot and she'll talk a lot. And I'd only really focused on the singing part and the fact that singing woman was in the name. But I heard the second half of that much more profoundly after my vocal injury, to think, wait a minute. The part of the teaching was, she's going to talk a lot. Like, that's part of being singing woman. I can still serve this role. I can still express myself in this way. And it was really meaningful to have that shift. And so in a way, the name grew with me, or I grew with the name. I mean, I think we've kind of informed each other. So I haven't gone for a new name is the conclusion there. I've decided I can stick with singing woman.
Yeah, but I mean, it is really fascinating. And it's fascinating how you sort of revisited, okay, so beyond the immediate translation, there was this slightly more expansive offering, you know, when you were to the family, like, oh, actually, you know, it encompasses something bigger and something more. And I know as a young kid, I mean, it sounds like you were writing music from the earliest days. Like, this was actually songwriting, and writing lyrics and writing music was just a part of your DNA almost, but not necessarily performing it until, like, a chunk later.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it did. Singing songs always came so naturally to me. And I think when times when people say, well, how do you write songs? To me, it was so curious, because I think, well, how do you not? Like, is everyone not singing songs? Are you not waking up and these words are coming out of you? Because it just seemed so automatic and natural to me. But I have always had a lot of stage fright. And so there was a kind of ongoing battle for a while to have this drive in me that wanted to share these songs and wanted to perform and see what happened. And then this very like physical fear that has kind of gone up and down over the years. But the drive to share them was so strong, eventually I figured out how to live with the stage fright.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting also, right? Because if you view your name as just descriptive, it's kind of cool and interesting. But if you view it as, and also this is kind of your job in community, then there's also this sense of, I'm wondering if you felt like, through this time, but this is kind of why I'm here. Like there's a job that I'm supposed to be doing, or like there's a sense of responsibility to a community that's larger than me that I show up in this way. And whether that was in any way, shape, or form a struggle when you really kind of didn't want to show up in the final part of that way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it was, because it is, in the sense of my name, it is my responsibility. And not that I would be, punished for not following through, but it was for so long, held as this guiding principle. And so that was part of that kind of struggle for sure, of like, but this is who I am and what I'm supposed to do and what I've been asked to do. And I want to do it, but I'm so scared to do it. And, all of those things would kind of swirl together.
Mm. At the same time, I mean, while this script is running in your life, you start to enter a season, which becomes a series of seasons of real challenge, on the level that so many others, I think we all step into these seasons at some point in our lives, but it really starts to touch down early in your life, I guess around 11 years old, when you look down one day and notice that one leg doesn't look like the other.
Yeah. Yeah. It was the summer before my 11th birthday that my left leg was larger than the other, that I was having really strong stabbing pains from within inside my leg. And, I'd be sitting there playing Nintendo and couldn't get comfortable flipping my legs over the chair, lying on the floor. It just hurt all the time. And I was in Montclair. I was having the summer with my dad and we'd gone camping and he said, oh, maybe it's a spider bite. And, there's crazy spiders here on the East Coast. And okay, maybe that's it. And maybe it's growing pains. Like, okay, maybe that's it. And when I got back home to Edmonton, Alberta, to start the school year with my mom, the pain didn't go away and it got quite a bit worse. And so, walk-in clinic, doctor, pediatrician, dots got connected very quickly to get me to the hospital and eventually a cancer diagnosis. I had a very large cancerous tumor on my left leg.
Yeah, which led to, I guess, first a long season of chemo and then eventually the decision when you're about 2 years later or so, I guess, 13, that a part of your leg was going to be amputated.
Yeah.
Which, is multiple layers of trauma, especially at an age where all you want to do at that age is fit in. You don't want most people that you just don't want to stand out. You're just like, can I please be accepted?
Yeah.
And then this sort of becomes your world to a certain extent.
Yeah. Yeah. So I had chemotherapy, radiotherapy, and it was Ewing sarcoma. It went into remission. But then it was another summer with my dad where I was like, man, my leg's starting to hurt again. And another fall diagnosis for the cancer had come back or never really gone. And so at that point, the cure was to amputate. That's all that was left. I mean, I'm really lucky. I'm really lucky that there was a cure. We all have lost people to cancer. Every single person I've ever met knows someone with cancer who's had cancer or has, had cancer themselves. Like it's everywhere. And so I was really fortunate that there was a cure. And absolutely, it thrust me into this very different life. And that was very far from what every other 13-year-old I knew outside of the hospital was having. And so I'd have this kind of sense of belonging in the hospital. But as soon as I got back into school, I was always different. I looked different. I moved different. I was going through something that no one knew what to say or how to act. And I think I felt on the outside for most of my adolescence and teenage years, because I was, you know, I was. And that's just how it was. I had one very good friend. She's very present in the book, Susan, who I think because we'd been besties since we were five or whatever, that she got it because she'd seen it happening. But everyone else, it was, I think in some ways I was a mystery. Fair enough. Like other teenagers, they don't know. Yeah. And I know now that that's an enormous experience and strain for a young person. I didn't really know it then. I didn't have a sense of the scope, you know, or the enormity of it. I think in some ways being young protected me from having a sense of how big a deal it was. And my mom did a pretty great job of, you know, taking things seriously, but also just trying to get me through it without showing her fear. So it was kind of late. It was in my 20s, really, when I actually finally started to grieve or suddenly got a chance to go, hey, wait a second. That was really scary and really hard and really unfair, you know, and like, look what I missed out on. And even now, as I'm getting to know other young adults, like I come from this weird place that none of them have been to. So, yeah, I mean, of course, I don't know anything else. It's kind of like writing songs, like what's a childhood without cancer? I don't know. But it was really impactful. And as you say, it was sort of the first big loss of a few.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting also the way that you've shared. There were sort of two cultures that you ended up for years really moving between. There's the culture, quote, out there, you know, like all the other kids, all the other families, like the people in the neighborhood, but also the culture of kids who were in various stages of treatment in the hospital, oftentimes in for long windows of time where, you know, the physical expression of what you're going through and what your body was taking on, which was very often, you know, brutal, was normalized. So it's almost like that became, for you, that becomes the normal. That becomes a place where you can exhale, because you kind of like, yeah, we're all going through this, and where you can be more of just you. Like that becomes the world that becomes, you know, better, and you know how to navigate and be with.
Yeah. And that's where I had belonging for those couple years, was in the hospital, was with other bald kids hooked up to machines and also puking their guts out. You know, and we like that there was, you know, pain in that and suffering in that, but there was also joy and jokes and playing and being kids together. And in we could be together in a way because all of those things were understood, and we weren't staring at each other the way we'd get stared at outside of the hospital, or we already understood, like, you know, we could just jump ahead to watching movies together or whatever. And I think I missed that. Once I was, you know, in recovery and after my leg was amputated, I missed having that, you know, even though I didn't miss being sick, I didn't miss being in treatment, but I missed that sense of familiarity.
Yeah. It's like there, you know, everyone knew how to be with each other. And then once you're outside of that, it sounds like people just really didn't understand how to be with you in a way that was just natural and comfortable.
Yeah.
Which I think adults don't understand how to navigate that, let alone in your teens where you're just trying to figure out which way is up anyway.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. You, music has always been a part of you, but it sounds like, you know, as you emerge out of high school, and start to say, okay, so I'm going to step into the real world. You tend towards, the world of film and production, and that kind of becomes your focus, but there's this adventure. You head over the other side of the pond for a chunk of time, the UK and then Amsterdam. And there's a moment there where something changes in your relationship to music and also eventually your vocation.
Yeah. And you know, it's interesting. We talked a bit about that, like wrestle with, am I really a singing woman? Should I be doing this? This is my responsibility. And I think for a while after high school, going into film school and working in television production, I was kind of avoiding it. That was me like still finding something that was like creative and still in, you know, media or production. And I enjoyed it. So it was still a fit, but I wasn't doing the thing I really wanted to do and was really drawn to do, but still figuring out early 20s, you know. And so yeah, I'd went on this you know, cliche, backpacking through Europe, Canadian thing, although truly unprepared because doing it on one leg was not easy. Now I'm like, what was I thinking? Whatever. Went to Europe and had been doing my travels, you know, and meeting people. And I was at this hostel in Amsterdam and had kind of joined up with a group of Scots and Brits who were on a bank holiday weekend. And, you know, it was late at night, early in the morning, hazy back room at the bar, and a guitar was going around the room, you know, as it does. and people are playing their cover songs, and the guitar got to me, and I had actually just started taking guitar lessons. I had been writing songs for a long time, but no one had ever heard them. And in that moment of the guitar being passed to me, I was like, okay, I can do an Indigo Girls cover, or for the first time ever, I can sing a song I wrote. And I played a song that I'd written. And in the moment, there was this pause, you know, the song ended, the notes are probably still ringing on the guitar, and it just hung in the air. And then one of the other, you know, travelers went, "Aye," and everyone started clapping. And it was the small moment, but I was so lifted by it, and it opened a door. It just showed me what it felt like to do that. I, you know, I felt like I became a singer in that moment. I became singing woman, or kind of like singing woman was revealed to me in a new way in that moment. Because I just was like, oh man, I want to feel that again. I want to feel this moment again where I gave something, they received it, they gave something back. We were having a moment, we're seeing each other. It was just that beautiful, you know, mix that music brings us, you know, as an audience member or as a creator. There can be an incredible magic that happens in music. We've all felt it, right? And it was a moment of feeling it, but I got to be on the side of generating it. It was like a superpower. So yeah, I went home from that trip in Europe and was like, all right, that's it. I want to do this. How do I do it? I don't know. But I had all of these songs bursting out of me, you know, figured out how to record them, found some open mic nights to go to. And that was the beginning of, yeah, making a shift into being a musician, professional musician.
Yeah. I mean, which is, it's interesting to sort of like, you know, feel like, on that one evening, something was revealed to you, because it wasn't really revealed to you. You knew it all along, but there was there was something that happened in that moment that allowed you to say, now, like, yeah, now is like, the time to stand fully in it, to be like this person.
Yeah. Yeah. And isn't that the way, you know, we can hear a lesson over and over, but suddenly in that moment, it made sense to me. It was the right time, kind of how 20 years after that, I heard that second half of, oh, she's going to talk a lot. You know, it just was the right time for me to truly get it.
Yeah. I'm fascinated with the concept of sliding doors, and I've asked this to a number of different people. Do you ever, or have you ever sort of reflected on that night and wondered, what if I said no when the guitar came around?
Oh, man. What if I had said no? You know, my guess is that it might have come at another time, that it might have kept knocking. but of course, I don't know. I mean, it felt like the stars aligned that night. And so if I'd made a different choice, maybe you and I wouldn't even be talking now. The whole world could be different. Sliding doors is incredible as an idea. I think it would have still come because it was percolating. But I'm really glad it happened that night. And the song I wrote about that night was just, it's still, I think it's just one of the best, not my best song, but one of my dearest, you know, 20 years later, whatever, hundreds of songs later, it's like, but that night, it just, so much came out of it. What good question. Where would I be?
What was the chorus to that song?
The chorus is, thank you for starting me off. Thank you for the invitation to join you. Because I felt like I was indebted to the people in that room. And it, of course, you're right. Like, I knew I was a singer. It was already there. But it just was like the alchemy of those people in that moment. I felt like they were part of me taking this step.
Yeah.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Since 2013, Bombas has donated over 100 million socks, underwear, and T-shirts to those facing homelessness. If we counted those on air, this ad would last over 1,157 days. But if we counted the time it takes to make a donation possible, it would take just a few clicks. Because every time you make a purchase, Bombas donates an item to someone who needs it.
Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Good Life Project is sponsored by Lumi. So listen, we have all had those awkward moments where a BO strikes at the worst possible time. I'm often actually out in nature when I'm exercising, so I don't even notice it when I'm out. And then I walk in the door, kind of start to wrinkle my nose, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute. That's actually me. That is why I'm so thankful I discovered Lumi Whole Body Deodorant. This revolutionary product, it was actually invented by an OBGYN who wanted a solution for her patients struggling with private odor. But Lumi doesn't just work, quote, down there. It provides incredible 72-hour protection for your entire body using mandelic acid. I kid you not, this stuff is a game changer. Lumi is safe and effective for pits, for feet, you name it. And as someone who's tried it, I can attest that it seriously works. The fresh scents are just an added bonus. So if you're ready to say goodbye to BO for good, try Lumi's Starter Pack. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash, and deodorant wipes, and free shipping. As a special offer for our listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with the code GOODLIFE at LumiDeodorant.com. Don't miss your chance to experience the relief of true full body freshness that equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit LumiDeodorant.com or just click the link in the show notes and use the code GOODLIFE. Good Life Project is sponsored by Quince. So my wife actually originally introduced me to Quince because she loves their clothing, and I have been hooked ever since. I literally lived in their Mongolian cashmere ribbed beanie and pullover hoodie pretty much all winter. And as the weather warms up, I wanted more breathable summer pieces without overpaying. And Quince has just the super high quality items like linen shirts, performance polos, activewear at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Quince partners directly with top factories, cutting out the middleman to pass savings to customers. Actually just ordered a new European linen long sleeve button down shirt. Super excited to get that. And I'm always just so amazed at how they can keep their prices so affordable while the quality remains really high. So if you're looking to upgrade your wardrobe, I highly recommend you try Quince. Go to quince.com/GLP for free shipping on your order and a 365-day return. That's quince.com/GLP to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/GLP or just click the link in the show notes. Trust me, your wardrobe will thank you. And talk about timing also. I mean, this was a moment that also it allowed you to really step fully into this, which would become not just your primary vocation for a long window of time, not just a form of creative expression for you, but also a place of homecoming and solace and coping to a certain extent, which you would really need, because coming home, the years that followed, were about to serve up some really, really hard experiences to you. I know you come back and you start to make the transition into the career as a musician and start to create albums, which requires, you know, like time in the studio, time writing, time performing locally, and then touring the albums. Your first album, I Fell Out of Oz, was the first album, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're about to start touring Oz. You simultaneously fall in love with somebody in relatively short order. You realize that you're going to have a baby, which for a chunk of years, because of what you had been through when you were earlier, it sounds like, you know, it was something where you were never entirely sure if that was going to be possible.
Yeah, I'd been told, you know, when I turned 18 and my pediatric oncology team was kind of handing me over to the adult care team, they were like, by the way, a bunch of long-term side effects of the chemo, possible like heart disease, maybe some other cancers, and likely difficulty like with fertility. And I was like, okay, well, I'm 18, so that's not on my radar. But I'd been operating like I might never be able to get pregnant, or that it would be hard for me to get pregnant, because that's what they said. And so, to be honest, I was a bit reckless for a while there. But I'd had one unplanned pregnancy earlier that I terminated, but that opened my eyes to like, oh, wait a second, turns out I can't get pregnant. And then in this relationship of, falling in love, fast and furious, and then another unplanned pregnancy, just as my album was coming out, this new album and this career that I'd, found myself in, and had to kind of go, oh, wait a second. Now there's going to be a baby. So what does it mean for the album? And I want this baby, but I also really wanted this career. And this relationship is new, and it kind of thrust us into, a very intense time together to figure out. I'm talking about the father of the baby and I figuring out, what do we want? I mean, he also was just about to start his MFA, and we were in our 20s and felt like the world was before us. And I mean, kids change things. Pregnancies change things. So I decided to kind of put music on hold a little bit, slow down, and wait for the baby to come, which was our first son, Emmett.
Which brings us to the next moment that would really bring you to your knees, and also introduces for the first time a question into your life that people would start asking you as you move through your adulthood. You lose Emmett. And which is a devastating, devastating experience for you, and something that you would have to be with, with this person who you're with, who would eventually, in the time following, become closer with you, and you would end up married. And but it also, as you're trying to figure out, like, how do I move forward after this absolutely horrendous experience? This question starts popping up, which is, when you meet people and you're at a certain age, at a certain time, and you're like married at that point, hey, do you have kids?
Yeah. That question for what year is it now? 2021, almost 15 years. That question has hit me in a lot of different ways. And so, Emmett died during labor. Effectively, I mean, I think officially the day after, because we did have him on life support for a day, which I'm grateful for. I got to hold his body and look at him and touch him and see him on the outside. But then we had to let him go. And so, do you have children? I mean, when you've lost a child, I mean, even for other reasons, it's a tough question for a lot of people, maybe who didn't ever want to have kids and are tired of talking about it. Or can't have kids, and that's a heartbreak. Or like me, who had lost a child, I would have different answers at different times. I could say yes, but he died. This after Emmett, or I could say no, and then I would feel like this punch in my stomach, because it meant so much to me to think of myself as a mother. And it would depend on who was asking and where I was and how I was doing and all of these different factors, always trying to kind of guess how it might go. Who am I talking to? Are they going to be okay with this, or just going to freak them out if I start talking about death? Because that happens. And that question, I mean, it's a question I try to never ask, even though I find myself all of these years later and everything that's happened, and now with a 3-year-old, that I will go to ask people, or a version of it, which is, do you have other kids? I'll be on the playground and you're just small talking with parents, how old are they? Oh, and then, oh, do you have other kids? And I'm like, no, don't do it. Don't do it. Even though it's like, it seems like such a normal question, but it can be so loaded. And so I try to never ask it, if someone offers that information, sure. But yeah, it was a hard question. And because after we had Emmett and got married, and we're once again feeling hopeful about our future, and I was making music again, and my ex was making art again. Okay, we can do this. We can get through this together. And then I got pregnant again with our son, Ford. And Ford was born with a hypoplastic left heart syndrome, very rare and very serious heart defect, and lived a really difficult life. And then he died when he was 14 months old. And so then the question again, do you have kids? It just got even harder, even harder. And, you know, in my book, like, it's called How to Lose Everything, and it has a lot of these experiences in it, cancer and bone cancer and thyroidectomy. But really, my sons are the everything, you know. Those other experiences are losses, but they don't have the expanse that the loss of my children does. And so, but it's still a question that I've yet to have a firm response. I've yet to have my go-to that always makes sense, even now with my daughter, because now it's like, I have one child, I have three children, or maybe none. I don't know. I don't know if I want to talk about it, you know. it stays something that I kind of grapple with because it touches on such heartache.
Yeah. You know, it occurs to me also that the question, to a certain extent, is, I mean, there's so many layers to it, but also if we go back to our earlier conversation with, okay, so at 2 years old, you know, you're given this role in the community. And part of that is to, I always view the role of the person who sings, the person who speaks, or the storyteller as a provider of ease, solace, connecting. And if you feel like that's a part of kind of why you're here, and you're going through this thing, which, or a series of experiences for you, which keeps pulling you away from people. And simultaneously you feel like, but I'm here to do this thing, which brings us all together. I wonder if that's anything that you have and maybe even still grapple with.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think similar to when I had cancer, there was ways, certainly in the early years after my sons died, that I was like, wow, here I am on the outside again. Here I am, someone who's had this extraordinary, rare, terrifying experience that no one seems to understand, because it's not happening to that many people. Or, you know, it does happen. It happens. But I certainly felt like, especially as each kind of bullet point of tragedy, that I was like, wow, I'm really, really starting to separate myself from the norm here. But coming back to then sharing those experiences, or my responsibility to do that, or yeah, what does that mean and what does that look like now? I did reach a point. I mean, at first, playing music was, like you said, it was solace for me. It was a way that I could move some of those emotions, you know, that I could sit at my piano. And a piano can take a lot, as can a guitar. You can really hit those things. I could sit there and I could bang the keys and I could sing, and you know, the songs would be coming out of me, these lyrics would be coming out of me, and this angerness and this, it's like bitter and sorrow, and all of these things would be pouring out of me through music. And I'm so grateful that I had that outlet. I mean, I think if I was a gardener, I would have just been like really digging up the garden, or like whatever your thing is, you know, but that was my thing. And I happen to know what my thing is, thank goodness. And so I could spend time doing that. And so at first, music came back really for me. It was like, this is for me. This is a way for me to get it out of me a little bit. And then as I started to still kind of process the experiences and as ever feel drawn to sharing them, I started to think about which of those songs were like purely cathartic and no one needs to hear. Okay, fine, that's that list. And then which of the songs are stories that I can share? And which of the songs are stories that will be an invitation for people to, you know, learn about something, or to, you know, feel their own sorrow and their own loss? Which of these songs can I give and offer and do my thing as singing woman, where we exactly get to connect and get to feel seen together and get to have this moment in music together where things kind of make sense for a second? And so after each loss, after my son Emmett died, I, you know, wrote another album. And then after Four died, I wrote another album and took those songs on the road. I mean, it's interesting, the thing about, like, even growing up with being told, oh, she'll sing a lot, she'll talk a lot, like those stories, right? We all tell ourselves stories about who we are. And you know, at some point, there's many of them where we realize we need to stop telling that story. Like, you can change them. We can change the stories we tell about ourselves. But there's such power in kind of repeating stories. And I got to, by being in a different town every night, by being on a different stage, say over and over, you know, this is what happened. This is my heartbreak. Can I show it to you? What's your heartbreak? And because it was a new crowd every night, I could kind of do it again and again. And it was a way for me to make sense of the experiences. You know, like, you know, if you're in a like car accident, like a fender bender, and for the next 2 weeks, it's like everyone you run into, you're like, did I tell you I was in a car accident? It was on Friday. Like, because you're trying to kind of get used to the story. You're trying to absorb it and figure out what your version of the story is. And so I had these huge experiences to try and make sense of. And through getting to just kind of share those stories through music and have people respond or have people, you know, connect with their own emotion, I got to like put pieces together in a way and do the thing that that I do. And so, yeah, there was still kind of sometimes that push and pull of music and motherhood and am I or am I not? And I think there was a way too, because, you know, even though I had felt some grief about having to put my career on hold, it's not that I didn't want to have my children. I mean, I sort of felt this moment of guilt of being like, well, I didn't mean this. I didn't mean that I'd rather have my music career than my kids. Like, that's who got the message wrong, because that's not what I meant. But kind of in the aftermath, in trying to make sense of it, in trying to pick up the pieces and trying to move forward somehow, that music came back and all of these pieces of, yeah, career and income and, but yeah, self-expression and being in service. You know, like you said, the storyteller, like it's being in service and allowing people to, you know, see their own stories.
Yeah. You write in your book, for a long time, until I had new things to hold on to, those moments of connection with an audience kept me alive. So it sounds like it was this bi-directional thing, you know, and it also, that line also kind of telegraphs this really interesting trajectory from there, you know, which is not so much getting over any of this, because that's not what happens, but figuring out, okay, so I'm waking up tomorrow or I'm waking up today. Okay, so how do I move into this day? And then the next day, and then the next day, and the next day, you know, where you start to say, okay, so I have to somehow create a life from this point forward. And using your language from a beautiful talk that you did a little while back, you know, not necessarily better, but different.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, after the loss of our children, and then our marriage ended, and then it really felt like, okay, what's left? That I did have to wake up and say, well, what can I create? Or what can I build? And go through a process of like, it's not what I wanted. It's not what I thought would happen, but what's possible? And I think, you know, when I talk about different instead of better, it's kind of being open to possibility, to being open to some mystery. I struggle with the word hope. I think people who have a discomfort with sorrow really want to talk about hope, and they're always being hope, and there isn't. Just factually, there's not always hope. Sometimes there is. Often there's hope. But for me, what became a way to be hopeful was to be open to mystery, was to say, okay, I don't know. I don't know what's coming. Maybe it'll get worse. Could. Maybe there'll be new things. And just kind of being open to that, that was a way that I found to move forward. It was like, I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be different. It's not going to be this. So let's see what happens. And I moved across the country. I'd been living in Vancouver for my adult life until then for 17 years, and moved to Toronto and, you know, started some new work, made some new friends, and just tried to, you know, pick up the pieces and build something new, but also have to like just find totally new pieces and recreate something for myself.
Yeah, it's sort of, it's not even about reassembling the same pieces into a different puzzle. It's a different puzzle.
Yeah.
You know, it's, and different pieces. And maybe you're fabricating the pieces as you go.
Yeah.
And just sort of like seeing what it looks like. There's a moment that you share while you're sort of in this process, and then you're really, you're sort of back and performing. the prosthetic leg that you had for many years was limited in a lot of ways. And I guess technology evolved to a point where there were microprocessor built things and things which would allow for a much more comfortable and natural gait and for you to move through the world differently. Being an artist and a performer in the music business, like so many, it's not necessarily, you know, you're not necessarily flush with huge piles of cash all day, every day.
No.
So this technology, you know, like while it's something that, you know, for you, it seems really appealing, is also incredibly expensive. And you decide to do something that was a pretty profound act of vulnerability, but also it showed you that you didn't just have an audience, you had a community.
Hmm. Yes. The knee raiser. That's what it's called. This moment in my life, the knee raiser. So as a performer, I'd actually tried to keep my disability not really secret, but I had a prosthetic cover and I always wore pants, and like a lot of people didn't know I only had one leg. And that's in part because I was reasonably afraid of how people would respond because of people's attitudes towards disability. But it reached a point where I got to try one of these microprocessor knees that are not covered by the healthcare programs we have here, and $40,000 knees, but you can try them for 2 weeks. You can get a 2-week trial of these exciting knees. And so I decided to try it just to see what it was like. I was like, okay, there's all this buzz about these knees. I remember what it was like to have two legs. Like, how great can this be? And it was amazing. It felt amazing. And the day that I had to give it back, I posted a photo on Facebook, you know, as one does, of me in the clinic saying, I've just got to use this knee. I got to, you know, go downstairs step over step for the first time in 20 years. You know, I got to have all these sensations, and now I'm giving it back. And I kind of feel like I'm, you know, turning into a pumpkin, like the Cinderella, you know, carriage at midnight. And all these people chimed in. First of all, we're like, wait, what? You only have one leg? And oh my God, that, you know, how we have to get this leg for you. What can we do? And I think, you know, not only did it show me that I belong to a community, I sometimes call it the leg that folk music bought, because it was like very much the folk community across Canada that made it possible, that were contributing. And there were some people, you know, like I had an uncle who threw in $2,000 or something. But for a lot of musicians, exactly, who don't have much money, they were putting in $10 or $20 or whatever they could. And it meant so much to me. And even like parents of the kids I grew up with, like I would see the contributions coming in and see these names and go, oh, that person. Like it was an incredible gift. I think everyone should get to see the range of lives that they've touched, because we don't know unless you throw a fundraiser and everyone signs up. So I got to feel this incredible amount of support, but I think it also gave people an opportunity to express it in a way, you know, that for a few years they'd wanted to, because people knew about my sons. I'd been sort of talking publicly because I was making these albums about loss, and, you know, people knew I'd lost one child and then a second child, and people ached for me, of course, and they didn't know what to do. And the knee raiser happened, and I think it gave them something to do. I think people were glad to be like, great, we can't fix those other things. Those things hurt, but we can make this difference for you. We can do this. This will improve this part of your life. Wonderful. Let's do it. And so it was profound, because I got to get this new knee that was life-changing. I felt this incredible amount of support and love and care that I had felt, but I also felt people's helplessness about it. And so this was a moment of like, oh, great, like you get to take action. I get to feel it. This makes sense. And so not only was it profound in those ways, because it had been such an exciting experience, I decided I wanted to do something to celebrate it or acknowledge this incredible act of community care. And so that's when I got the flower leg, which is this floral cosmesis, meaning just like the cover on my prosthetic leg, which, as mentioned, I'd always tried to go for the ones that pass but don't really, like the, you know, something that sort of looks like my skin tone, but it was like a nylon over foam. Anyways, but I decided to do something that wasn't going to hide it and was in fact going to point a neon sign to it. And I got this cover made where I actually found this linen upholstery fabric that I love. It's laminated onto the fiberglass. And so It's now this incredibly striking accessory. Goes with everything. And now I tend to show it off. Like I have my pants tailored to just have one leg, or I wear skirts or whatever, because I love to show it. And it's sort of like that moment in the Amsterdam bar, like, or the sliding doors. Like, I might not have taken that step to make this part of myself so visible in a way that is celebratory and decorative if it hadn't been as a response to all of the support that I'd received. And then in turn, that flower leg has transformed my life. It's changed how I see myself as a disabled person. It's changed how people look at me as a disabled person. It's changed the conversations about it. And all of these things I had no idea would come out of putting some flowers on my leg. And so, of course, now I can kind of look back and connect those dots and say, okay, this led to that and this led to that. But I don't know if there would have been another way to get to this point with my leg.
Yeah, I mean, what an amazing just moment and experience. And, you know, it sounds like when you put up that first simple post, you know, and you're kind of like, oh, I'm giving this back. The intention was maybe just to be a little bit vulnerable, but your community was, like you said, waiting. Even if they didn't know that this was a part of your truth, they knew, you know, what you had been through in addition to that. And they wanted to do something. They wanted to say, we've got you in some way, shape, or form, but didn't know how. And this gave them like just a very straightforward, easy vehicle to say, like, we got you, we appreciate you. And it's almost like you're giving them a gift,
yeah,
of saying, there's this easy action that'll help support.
But I think I didn't know how to ask. And I think I didn't quite realize I was asking in that moment too, right? And you're right, it is a gift. And I think I've certainly been on the end of that too, or sometimes when people ask, like, what should I be doing to support someone who's going through something? And I mean, it's we don't want to be a burden, and a lot of us have that mentality, but really people want to help. They want to do what they can, mostly. I think that's mostly true. And so, yeah, it was this moment that I gave people permission, an invitation to do something. And it was vulnerable. I mean, I sort of share the photo on the anniversary every now and then, because I think it's in the clinic and you see the prosthetic leg. And so it was even a way of just showing like my body that I hadn't done before because of my own discomfort around having a disabled body. And so, yeah, it was a step that has led to a lot of other kind of undoing of my own, you know, ableism and self-consciousness of saying, okay, this is what I look like. Okay. Okay. This is what I need. Oh, okay. You know, and then being caught, being accepted. Yeah.
Yeah. It's really interesting to hear you sort of say of the undoing of my own ableism. Cause I think when we think about it from the outside looking in, you're sort of like, well, no, it's always others, you know, like with ableism towards somebody who is living with a disability rather than, but you can't do that to yourself. But in fact, you know, it sounds like part of the internal dialogue with you was a certain amount of rejecting a part of who you were, or wanting to keep it hidden as much as possible, maybe for different reasons. Maybe, you know, like you said, going back to the early part of a conversation, at the end of the day, we all just want to belong.
Mm. Yeah. And I mean, like, internalized ableism is unavoidable. And for a long time, I would have very concrete, real thoughts of, I don't want to look like this, which is a crummy feeling, right? We've all felt that. We've all had those moments. But and we kind of know intellectually where that standard comes from. And we know the problems with it, and that we're all impacted by this, like, homogenized, you know, European centric idea of beauty and all of those things. But the experience of it is really hard, and it hurts, right? And I often thought, I don't want to look like this. I don't like the way that I walk. I don't like the way that, you know, it feels. And I see my, you know, and all of this negativity towards myself, because I hadn't been shown disabled bodies as beautiful or strong or interesting the way that certain bodies are shown to us as beautiful and strong. I mean, that's the power of representation, right? And so most of us have had to grapple with that a little bit, but it took time to undo it. And I mean, bless social media for like the knee raiser, for putting that post and something coming out of it. But that's also where I started to see other disabled people, and it, you know, was inspired to question why I had these ideas about myself and started to see, you know, other people rocking their prosthetic legs or whatever it is, and having more conversations about representation and disability. And so all these things were kind of happening at the same time and feeding each other.
Yeah.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
When it comes to your finances, you think you've done it all. You've saved, you've researched, and you've invested all that you can. Now it's time to take those investments to the next level by using the brand behind every great investor, Yahoo Finance. As America's number one finance destination, Yahoo Finance has everything you need, whether you're a seasoned trader or just dipping your toes into the market. Join the millions of investors who trust Yahoo Finance to guide them on their financial journey. For comprehensive financial news and analysis, visit yahoofinance.com, the number one financial destination, yahoofinance.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
At the same time also, so you're in Toronto now, the other side of the country, really sort of like building a different life, a new career, being much more front and center also, and you know, like performing. Music is still your jam. And then you end up with thyroid cancer.
Yeah.
which is like, it's this bizarre thing where like people are like, you know, like it's like the classic old joke with thyroid cancer, like good news, bad news.
Yeah.
You know, like on the one hand, it's the big C. On the other hand, it's the best one to get. Like I've heard that story from a number of different people now. You have surgery to remove the thyroid. As a singer, there's a little bit of stuff that goes wrong afterwards, which requires you to be rushed back. And for a chunk of time, affects your ability to sing, which going back to, okay, so now I've just grappled with this, you know, thing that's been a part of me since I was 13 years old. And I'm now in a place where I am completely and utterly public and owning it and celebrating it. And then this other part of me, which has been decreed as a significant part of my identity since I was 2, which is singing woman. Well now I'm struggling to do that.
Yeah. It was a blow. It was like, yeah, exactly. It wasn't the big C. It was like, yeah, I was fed the same line. It's not breast cancer. It's not lung cancer. Like, this is, we can live with this. But as a singer, it was drastic. And I definitely had a moment of like, really? Really? Thyroid cancer? Like, come on. Like, all of this other shit has happened. And now this? Like, gonna cut me some slack? So I struggled with it. I really, because I felt like, yeah, here I am. I'm figuring out how to move forward. I'm getting myself up every day. I'm creating something. I'm proud of myself. Like, ugh. and then I had this setback. Ugh. And it put everything on hold for a little while there. It did mean that in having to sit with questioning, who am I as singing woman? If I'm not singing, what am I doing? What else about me matters? What is it about Singing Woman that matters? And what do I want? And it was in that downtime of not getting to perform and having to stay in one place, which I hadn't done in a long time. I mean, there's this beauty of touring and performing and getting to connect and getting to share my story and all of that stuff. But also it was definitely some escapism and coping for a while. There was just keep myself moving, keep moving, keep moving. And so there I was, I had to sit still. And when I thought about performing and writing, I thought, well, what I really love is getting to connect with people. So if I can't sing, how else can I do that? Is there another way I can do that? And that's when that other part of the teaching, you know, came clear to me, that she's going to talk a lot part. I thought, okay, well, I can talk. Maybe I'll write. Maybe I'll do more radio stuff I'd been doing. And also it was, you know, and, you know, it's this thing of different, not better. It's not like I wanted to have thyroid cancer, but it was in that moment where I started to think about and be open to and be in touch with my desire to potentially have a third child, which, you know, understandably was this big question of like, would I even try? Do I even want to go there? But it really came in having to slow down and sit back and say, okay, if I'm going to lose that thing that means so much to me, what do I want? What do I want? And then it was like, well, you kind of really want a kid. And you do still really want to connect and tell stories, but maybe there's this other way you can do it. And so those things started to become clear. And so, you know, it's this way of like, I'm not grateful for the thyroidectomy that went wrong for a minute there. But this is what came out of it.
Yeah. And by this, it's you moving into the world now as a storyteller, not always with music, you know, whether it's, like you said, on the written page, on the stage, sharing words and language and stories, on the radio where you are now on a regular basis. And then also, like you said, saying, okay, so number three, I want to say yes to this, which... You know, there's so many layers there.
Yeah.
You know, because you're not just saying yes to a child at that point, saying I'm gonna try this again, but you're saying yes to the very visceral, you know, like lived experience of saying, and this might be yet another being, that may not be here, you know, by the time that I'm no longer here, and you're saying yes to that in a way that, you know, like most others can intellectualize a decision, but you've lived it.
Yeah. I knew that in trying to have a third child, you know, and people talk about like, there's always this awareness of miscarriage. Like people won't necessarily say they're pregnant until that kind of 12 week mark. And then I feel like people think they're in the clear and I'm always like, you're not in the clear. Just a terrible thing. I don't say that out loud, but I exactly have this very, you know, strong awareness and understanding of what else can go wrong. And so for me, the thought of trying to have another child meant being open to all the things that can go wrong. It's how I saw it. And of course, being open to that it could go right. But even then, it was like, okay, if this goes as well as possible, which is, you know, carrying a baby full term, having a live birth, bringing that healthy baby home, I mean, that's the ideal, right? And there can be versions of that that still work out. But it was like, even if I bring home a perfect, healthy, full-term baby, I will then also have to probably bump into some grief that I've been leaving alone. Because it's going to remind me of things. I'm going to see things in this baby that I missed with Emmett and Ford. Like, I knew going into it that I would have to also be open to touching on that grief or being triggered sometimes. And that was going to be part of parenting for me. And so I had to be ready for that, which took time.
Yeah. You said yes. You said yes to a lot of things in that season. As we sit here and have this conversation, you know, you have a beautiful 3-year-old daughter and, you know, this career where the singing voice has returned. Maybe not entirely like 100% to what you like, but you have the ability to sing, you have the ability to speak, you have the, You've written this gorgeous book, How to Lose Everything, which really sort of walks people through so much of what we've explored. And, you know, it's interesting because if you were to take a snapshot, not look at the movie of how you got here, but literally just take a snapshot of you now, you know, that looks like a beautiful life.
It's a beautiful life.
You know, and but at the same time, the movie that brought you to this frame in the film is what brought you to this moment. And there was a lot of brutality and suffering and grief.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a fascinating mess. A beautiful, mysterious mess. Because, you know, kind of saying, like, with thyroid cancer, like, you know, I wouldn't have chosen to have cancer when I was 11. If someone had said, you know, bone cancer, yes or no? I said, no, thanks. But at the same time, I can't imagine who I would be without it. And so to wish that away would be to kind of wish myself away, who I am and who I am in this world and how I see it and experience it. And that's true for all those other losses. And so it's not like those are things that I'm like grateful for. And again, the losses of my sons, I wish that Emmett had lived, or I wish that Ford had lived, or both of them. God, my life would be completely different if one or both of them had lived. I'd probably still live in Vancouver, might still be in that marriage, or at least parenting with that person. And I wouldn't be here. And I in a way long for that alternate reality. And I love my life right now. I, you know, love my little family, my partner and my daughter, and the things that have been happening in my work and my career. Like, these are really satisfying, fulfilling. You know, the book was so fulfilling to create and to share. And my daughter is just, you know, the best in the world. And I can't imagine life without her. And so just the way that those truths kind of bump into each other, and that all of those things brought me here. And so there's ways, you know, like, I wouldn't choose them or plan for this. And yet here I am. And it is a beautiful picture at this point in my life. Incredibly blessed. I feel so blessed. You know, and that's even in the middle of a pandemic, knock on wood, like, healthy and housed and employed and with my family. And I mean, who could ask for more?
Which feels like a good place for us to come full circle as well. So sitting in this container of the Good Life Project, if I offer up the phrase to live a good life, what comes up?
For me, to live a good life is to make music in any way, shape, or form. And to be open to mystery.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening. And thanks also to our fantastic sponsors who help make this show possible. You can check them out in the links we have included in today's show notes. And while you're at it, if you've ever asked yourself, what should I do with my life? We have created a really cool online assessment that will help you discover the source code for the work that you're here to do. You can find it at sparkatype.com. That's sparkatype.com, or just click the link in the show notes. And of course, if you haven't already done so, be sure to click on the subscribe button in your listening app so you never miss an episode. And then share the love. If there's something that you've heard in this episode that you would love to turn into a conversation, share it with people and have that conversation. Because when ideas become conversations that lead to action, that's when real change takes hold. See you next time.